This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The Dwarves, written by Marcus Heitz, translated by Sally Ann Spencer, read by Matthew Wolfe. Appearances are there to be ignored, for the biggest hearts may reside in the smallest and unlikeliest creatures. Those who fail to look beyond the surface will never encounter true virtue, not in others, and certainly not in themselves. From Collected Wisdom of a Dead Stranger, in Philosophical Letters and Texts, from the archive of the Hundred-Pillared Temple of Palandiel in Zamina, Kingdom of Ran Ribastur. Dwarves and mountains have one thing in common. It takes an almighty hammer and a tremendous amount of persistence to overcome them. Traditional saying from the Merc region, northeast Eiderslane. Fleeing from an angry dwarf requires fleetness of foot, for consider this. The target of dwarven wrath must be capable of outstripping the irate warrior's flying axe. Those lucky enough to escape with their lives should take pains to alter their appearance. The dwarven memory is dangerously good. Even after 20 cycles, the threat remains, and no one can predict when the chamber might ring with vengeful dwarven laughter as a tankard smashes against the offender's head. From Notes on the Races of Girdlegard, Singularities and Oddities. From the archive of Viranciensis, Kingdom of Tabain, compiled by the Master of Folklore, M.A. Het, in the 4299th solar cycle. Part 1. Prologue. Northern Pass, Stone Gateway to the Fifthling Kingdom, late summer, 5199th solar cycle. Pale fog filled the canyons and valleys of the Grey Range. The Dragon's Tongue, Great Blade, and other peaks towered defiantly above the mist, tips raised toward the evening sun. Slowly, as if afraid of the jagged peaks, the ball of fire sank in the sky, bathing the northern pass in waning red light. Glendalin Hammerstrike, of the clan of the Striking Hammers, recovered his breath. Leaning back against the roughly hewn wall of the watchtower, he cupped his hand to his bushy brown eyebrows and shaded his eyes from the unaccustomed light. The ascent had been grueling, and his close-woven chainmail, two axes, and shield weighed heavy on his aged legs. There was no one younger to stand watch in his stead. Only a few orbits previously, the 9 clans of the Fifthling Kingdom had been attacked in their underground halls. Many had lost their lives in the battle, but the young and inexperienced were the first to fall. Then came the sickness. No one knew where it had sprung from, but it preyed on the dwarves, sapping their strength, clouding their vision, and enfeebling their hands. And so it was that Glendalin, despite his age, was guarding the gateway that night. 2 vast slabs of solid rock, erected by Vrakas, god and creator of the dwarves, stemmed the tide of invading beasts. For some, the sight of the imposing gateway was not enough of a deterrent. Bleached bones and twisted scraps of armor were all that remained of them now. The solitary sentry unhooked a leather pouch from his belt and poured cool water down his parched throat. A few drops spilled out of the corners of his mouth, flowing through his black beard. Elegant braids, the work of untold hours, hung from his chin and rested on his chest like delicate cords. Glendalin replaced the pouch, took his weapons from his belt, and laid them on the parapet. The steel axe heads jangled melodiously against the sculpted rock, carved like the rest of the stronghold from the mountain's flesh. A ray of sunlight glowed red on the polished inscriptions, illuminating the runes and symbols that promised their bearer protection, a sure aim, and long life. Glendalin turned to the north, his brown eyes sweeping the mountain pass, 30 paces across, that led from the watchtower into the outer lands. No one knew what lay there. In times gone by, human kings had dispatched adventurers in all directions, but the expeditions were rarely successful, and the few who returned to the gateway brought orcs in their wake. He scanned the pass carefully. The beasts learned nothing from their defeats. Their vicious, choleric minds compelled them to throw themselves against the dwarves' defenses. They were bent on destroying anyone and anything in their path, for their creator, the Dark Lord Teon, had made them that way. The raids were conducted in blind fury. Raging and screaming, the beasts would scale the walls. From the first tinges of dawn light until the setting of the sun, armor would be cleaved from flesh and flesh from bone. A tide of black, dark green and yellowy-brown blood would lap against the impregnable gates, while battering rams and projectiles shattered as they hit the stone. The children of Vrakas suffered casualties, deaths, and crippling injuries too, yet it never occurred to them to quarrel with their fate. They were dwarves, Girdlegard's staunchest defenders.
"And yet we were almost defeated."
Glendalin's thoughts turned again to the strange beings that had invaded the underground halls, killing many of his kinsfolk. No one had seen them approach. Outwardly, they resembled elves, tall, slim, and graceful, but as warriors, they were savage and ruthless. Glendalin was almost certain that the creatures were not elves. There was no love lost between the dwarves and their pointy-eared neighbors. Vrakas and Sitalia, goddess and creator of the elves, had ordained the races with common loathing from the moment of their birth. Their differences had resulted in feuds, the occasional skirmish, and sometimes death, but never war.
"Then again," he thought critically, "I might be wrong. Perhaps the elves hate us enough to draw arms against us, or maybe they're after our gold."
A bitter northerly wind whistled round the mountaintops, gusting through Glendalin's braided beard. Suddenly, his brow furrowed angrily as his nostrils detected a stench that offended the core of his being. Orcs. Spilled blood, excrement and filth, that was the perfume of orcs, mixed in with the rancid odor of their greasy apparel. They basted their armor with fat, believing that the dwarves' axes would slither over the metal and leave them unharmed.
"No amount of fat will save them."
Glendalin did not wait for the ragged banners and rusty spears to appear over the final incline of the path. Standing on tiptoe, he placed his calloused hands on the coarse wooden handles of the bellows. A low drone vibrated through the shafts and galleries of the Fifthling Kingdom. The dwarf worked two bellows in rotation to produce a constant stream of air. Gathering in volume, the drone became a single piercing note, loud enough to rouse the soundest of sleepers. Now, as so often in their history, the Fifthlings were being summoned to fulfill their noble duty as Girdlegard's protectors. Sweating from the exertion, Glendalin glanced over his shoulder. Teon's beasts had formed a wide front and were marching on the gateway, more numerous than ever before. Elves would have fled to the woods, and a man's heart would have stopped at the sight of the monstrous hordes. The dwarf stood his ground. The attack on the gateway came as no surprise to Glendalin, but the timing was unsettling. The coming battle would stretch the dwarves' resources more than usual.
More bloodshed and more death.
The defending warriors lined up on the battlements on either side of the gateway. Their movements slow, some lurching rather than walking, weak fingers wrapped loosely around the hafts of their axes. The band of dwarves stumbling to the defense of the gates numbered no more than 100 brave souls. 1,000 would have been too few. Glendalin's watch was at an end. He was needed elsewhere.
"Don't forsake us, Vrakas. We're outnumbered," he whispered,
unable to rest his eyes from the stinking stream of orcs that poured along the path. Grunting, shouting, and jostling, they headed for the gates. The bare rock cast back their bestial cries, the echo mingling with their belligerent chants. The strident noises jangled in his mind, and it seemed to him that the beasts had somehow changed. There was a palpable air of confidence about the raging, shouting mob. For the first time, he was afraid of the beasts. What he saw next did nothing to ease his mind. Scanning the ranks of the invading army, his gaze fell on a cluster of lofty fir trees. Since childhood, he had watched them thrive and grow on the otherwise barren slopes. Now, they were sickly and dying.
The trees are faring no better than we.
Glendalen's thoughts were with his wounded and ailing friends.
What strange forces are these? Your children need you, Flaccus.
He prayed briefly, gathering his axes from the parapet.
With growing dread, he pressed his lips to the runes.
Don't abandon me now,
he enjoined the blades softly, before turning and hurrying down the steps to join the small troop of defenders. He reached them just as the first wave of beasts struck the wall. Quivering arrows rained down on the dwarves. Ladders were thrust against the walls, and orcs hastened to scale the wobbly rungs, while others set down their catapults and launched burning projectiles to reinforce the bombardment. Leather pouches, filled to the brim with paraffin, spluttered through the air and burst on impact, covering everything around them in an oily liquid and setting it ablaze. The first salvo was aimed too low, but the dark hordes were undeterred by the sight of their front line burning in a storm of fire. Nothing, not the battery of stones nor the torrent of molten ore, could check their rapacious zeal. For every orc that was slain, 5 new aggressors scaled the walls. This time they were determined to breach the defences. This time the gateway was destined to fall.
Look out!
Glendalen ran to the aid of a dwarf whose shoulder had been pierced by an arrow. One of Teon's minions, a stunted creature with thick tusks and a broad nose, had seized his chance and squeezed through an embrasure, hauling himself over the parapet and onto the battlements. Dwarf and orc stared at each other in silence. The clamour of voices, the hissing of arrows, the clatter of axes faded to an indistinct buzz. Glendalen's ears were tuned to his opponent's heavy breath. The red-veined eyes, buried deep within the head, flicked nervously from side to side. The dwarf knew exactly what was going on inside the creature's mind. The orc was the first of its kind to have set foot on the battlement and could scarcely believe its good fortune. A foul odor rose from the thick gray layer of tallow that coated its armor plating. The smell filled Glendalen's nostrils, drawing his attention back to the battle. Shrieking, he threw himself against the beast. His shield jabbed smartly downward, shattering his opponent's foot, while he lunged with his axe from above. The blade smashed through the unarmored flesh around the armpit. The orc's arm, sliced cleanly at the joint, fell to the stony floor. Dark green blood sprayed upward from the open wound. The orc let out a high-pitched scream, for which he was rewarded by a mighty stroke perpendicular to the neck.
Tell your kinsfolk I am anxious to make their acquaintance!
Glendalen gave the dying brute a final shove and sent him tumbling against the parapet, where he took the next invader with him as he fell. They vanished over the side and plummeted to the ground.
With any luck, they'll crush half a dozen others, thought Glendalen.
From then on, the enemy gave him no respite. Running from one end of the parapet to the other, splitting helms, cleaving skulls, ducking arrows and evading firebombs, he felled orc after orc. Darkness was descending on the stone gateway, but Glendalen was untroubled by the fading light. Even the thickest gloom could be penetrated by sharp dwarven eyes. But each blow and every movement took its toll on his weary arms, shoulders and legs.
Flaccus, grant us a moment to gather our forces, he coughed,
rubbing his braids across his face to free his eyes of blood. The dwarven deity took pity on his children. A fanfare of horns and bugles bade the hordes cease their assault, and the orcs complied, pulling away from the walls. Glendalen dispatched a lingering assailant and sank to the stone floor, fumbling for his drinking pouch. He tore off his helmet and poured water over his sweat-drenched hair. The cool fluid trickled over his skin, revitalizing his will.
How many of us remain?
He stumbled to his feet and went in search of survivors. Of the 100-strong army, 70 were left, among them the formidable figure of the Fifthling Monarch. Nowhere were the enemy corpses stacked higher than at Giselbert Ironeye's feet. His shiny armor, made of the toughest steel forged in a dwarven smithy, gleamed brightly, and his diamond-studded belt caught the flames that licked from pools of burning oil. He climbed atop a stone ledge to speak to his folk.
Stand firm!
Steady and true, his voice sounded across the battlements.
Be as unyielding as the rock from which we were hewn. nothing. No orc, no ogre, no creature of Teon will break us. We will cut them to pieces, as dwarves have done for millennia. Vrakas is with us!
The speech was met with low cheers and grunts of approval. The dwarves had been dealt a blow, but already their confidence was returning. They had grit and pride enough to stop the enemy in its tracks. The warriors replenished their weary bodies with food and dark ale. With every sip and mouthful, they felt stronger, more alive. The worst injuries were treated as time and circumstance permitted, gaping wounds sewn hurriedly together with fine twine. Glendalin found himself a space on the floor beside Glamdolin's strong arm. The two friends ate in silence, watching the mass of orcs that had retreated 100 paces from the gates. To Glendalin's eyes, it seemed the enemy had formed a living battering ram, intent on smashing down the gateway with their flesh.
"Such persistence," he said softly. "I've never seen them as dogged as they are tonight. Something has changed."
The thought of the dying trees sent a chill down his spine. All of a sudden, an axe clattered to the floor beside him. Turning just in time, he saw his companion slump forward.
"Glamdolin!"
He caught hold of the dwarf, and was dismayed to see delicate beads of sweat glistening on his forehead, drenching his face and his beard. His reddened eyes were glazed and unseeing. Glendalin knew at once that the mystery illness had claimed another victim, finishing what the enemy had left half done.
"Get some rest. The fever will soon be over."
Hauling Glamdolin's heaving body to one side, he settled him as comfortably as he could, knowing full well that the illness was probably fatal. The long wait sapped the strength of dwarves and orcs alike. Fatigue, the warrior's enemy, set in. Glendalin dozed on his feet until his helmet hit the parapet with a thud. Awaking with a start, he looked around anxiously. Yet more of his kinsmen had fallen prey to the sickness. Fortune had turned her back upon the children of the smith. A bugle call rent the air, setting his heart racing. In the cold light of the moon, he watched the approaching rows of colossal silhouettes, 4 times as tall as the orcs. There were 40 of them. Their hideous bodies were clad in poorly wrought armor, and their monstrous hands clasped fir saplings, roughly fashioned into clubs. Ogres. The dwarves' defenses would crumble if the giants were to scale the walls. The cauldrons of molten slag were empty, the cache of stones depleted. For a moment, Glendalin's doubts returned. But a glance at Giselbert's gleaming figure assured him that evil would be defeated in the time-honored way. The mass of orcs stirred, and a cheer went up as the ogres approached. Marching to the head of the army, the enormous beasts, uglier and more oafish than even the orcs, deposited their grappling irons, the 4 prongs of which were the length of a fully grown man. They attached long chains to the stem of each hook.
"The apparatus is ill-suited to climbing," thought Glendalin. "The beasts intend to topple the walls."
Whistling through the air, 3 dozen claws buried themselves in the stonework. A shouted order summoned the watching orcs to join the ogres in their tug of war. A crack of whips sounded, and the jangling links pulled taut. Glendalin heard the wall groan softly. The stronghold, built many cycles ago by his kinsmen, was no match for the beast's raw power.
"Quick! Bring the wounded to safety!"
he bellowed. The party of dwarves, responsible for tending the cauldrons, left their stations and carried off Glamdolin and the other ailing warriors. Masonry crumbled as a section of crenellated battlement ripped from the wall. The grappling hook went into freefall amid the showering stonework, killing 2 ogres and 10 orcs. The enemy forces held their ground. Soon the hook was ripping through the air again, poised to sink its claws into the wall. This time, the dwarves retreated, abandoning the parapet just in time. They took up position in the barbican above the gates. Glendalin listened as a large section of wall crashed and shattered on the ground below. The earth quaked, and the invading army howled in triumph.
"Good luck to them," thought Glendalin, endeavoring to stay calm. "I hope they dash their brains out on the doors."
The gateway was built to withstand more than a few paltry grappling irons. He peered cautiously over the steel-plated wall. More reinforcements were on their way. Horsemen mounted on jet-black steeds galloped to the head of the army of ogres and orcs. Glendalin instantly recognized the pointed ears of the tall, slim creatures. A red glow shone from the horses' eyes, and their hooves struck the ground in a shower of white sparks. Two riders thundered to the gateway and gave orders to the troops. The orcs and ogres set about clearing the pathway of fallen masonry so the assault could start afresh. Wheeling round on their horses, the riders found safe quarter from which to watch. One of the two creatures unshouldered a mighty bow and knocked an arrow against the woven bowstring. The marksman's gloved fingers held the weapon loosely as he bided his time. Hastily, the fifthlings pushed boulders over the parapet and onto the beasts below. The enemy flinched, jostling to evade the projectiles, and three of the orcs turned to flee. The archer raised his bow. Before the deserters could take flight, the first arrow, too fast for Glendalin to follow, sang through the air, and an orc fell to its knees. Already a second missile, uncommonly long for an arrow, sped from the archer's bow. The second beast perished, shrieking, followed a moment later by the third. The remaining minions took heed of the warning and resumed their work on the pathway. The orcs did not venture a protest at the murder of their kinsmen. By the coming of dawn, the path had been cleared. The fifthlings marveled at the scene unfolding before their eyes. The sky had brightened in the east, heralding the rising of the sun, yet a thick bank of fog loomed in the north, its luminous center, a maelstrom of black, red, and silver, flickered with coursing light. In defiance of the wind, it rolled toward the gateway, sweeping over the beasts below. The raucous orcs fell silent, huddling nervously together and shrinking away from the fog. Stooping, the ogres allowed it to pass. As if hailing their leader, the riders bowed their heads and saluted the vaporous mass. The shimmering mist lowered itself gently to the ground and hovered in front of the horses. Then, the unthinkable happened. With a shudder, the first of five bolts on the doors shot from its cylinder. The gateway quaked. Someone had spoken the incantation, delivering Girdlegard into the clutches of the invading hordes.
"No!"
bellowed Glendalin, turning his back to the enemy and leaning over the inner wall to seek the culprit below.
"No dwarf would ever... Glumdulin's strong arm!"
Alone, the dwarf was standing by the doors, lips moving, hands raised in supplication.
"Silence!"
Glendalin bellowed.
"Can't you see what you're doing?"
His shouts fell on deaf ears. The second lock glowed brightly, illuminated by the runes. The bolt creaked back.
"He's been bewitched," muttered Glendalin. "The fog has infected his mind."
The third bolt left its ferrule and shot free. At last, the custodians of the gateway stirred. Springing to their feet, they darted down the staircase, racing to put a stop to the treacherous magic before it was too late. The fourth bolt drew back. With one bolt remaining, Glamdolin was still standing unchallenged on the pathway.
"Time is against us,"
Glendalin thought grimly.
"Forgive me, Fracas, but I have no choice."
He gripped his axe and hurled it with all his might and fury at his comrade in arms. The blade sliced through the air, spinning, then plunged sharply toward the ground. Glendalin's aim was unerring, and the axe drove home. Glamdolin groaned as the weapon struck his shoulder. Blood spraying from the wound, he stumbled to the ground. Watching from above, Glendalin sent a quick thanks to Vrakas for guiding his blade. His relief was short-lived. Death had come too late to prevent the traitor from achieving his terrible purpose. The final bolt shot back. Slowly, the colossal gateway opened. The vast slabs scraped and dragged across the ground, as though reluctant to obey the treacherous command. There was a grinding noise of stone on stone. The chink became a narrow channel, which widened to fill the breadth of the path. Time slowed to a crawl as the gate swung open. One final creak, and for the first time in creation, the path into Girdlegard was clear.
No!
Glendalin stirred from his paralysis and hurtled down the steps to join Giselbert and the remaining warriors defending the gates. He was the last but one to take his place in the doorway. Already, the others had closed ranks and were holding their shields in front of their bodies, their axes held aloft. Shoulder to shoulder, they formed a low wall of flesh against the tide of orcs, ogres, trolls, and riders. 40 against 40,000. The enemy hung back, fearing an ambush. Never before had the gates opened to allow their passage. Glendalin's gaze swept the front line of monstrous beasts, shifting back to survey the second, third, fourth, fifth, and countless other grunting rows, all poised for the attack. He glowered from under his bushy eyebrows, forehead furrowing into a frown. Giselbert lost no time in reversing the incantation. At the sound of his voice, the gates submitted to his authority, swinging back across the pathway, but moving too slowly to stop the breach. Giselbert strode behind his troops, laying a hand on each shoulder. The gesture was a source of solace as well as strength, calming and rallying the last defenders of the gates. Trumpets blaring, the riders ordered the attack. The orcs and ogres brandished their weapons, shouting to drown out their fear, and the army advanced with thundering steps.
"The path is narrow! Meet them line by line and give them a taste of our steel!"
Glendalin called to his kinsfolk.
"Vrakas is with us! We are the children of the smith!" "The children of the smith!"
the fifthlings echoed, feet planted firmly on the rocky ground beneath. 4 dwarves were chosen to form the final line of defense. Throwing down his shield, the king took an axe in each hand and led the surge toward the enemy. The dwarves, all that remained of Giselbert's folk, charged out to slay the invaders. 10 paces beyond the gateway, the armies met. The fifthlings tunneled like moles through the vanguard of orcs. With only one axe with which to defend himself, Glendalin struck out, slicing through the thicket of legs. He did not stop to kill his victims, knowing that the fallen bodies would hinder the advancing troops.
"No one gets past Glendalin!"
he roared. Stinking blood streamed from his armor and helm, stinging his eyes. When his axe grew heavy, he clasped the weapon with both hands.
"No one! Do you hear?"
His enemy's bones splintered, splattering him with hot blood. Twice he was grazed by a sword or a spear, but he battled on regardless. The prize was not survival, but the closing of the gates. Girdlegard would be safe if they could stave off the invasion until the passageway was sealed. Until this hour, his axe had defended him faithfully, but now the magic of its runes gave out. Glancing to his right, Glendalin saw a comrade topple to the ground, skull sliced in half by an orc's two-handed sword. Seething with hatred, and determined to fell the aggressor, Glendalin lunged once, twice, driving his axe into the creature's belly and cleaving it in two. A shadow loomed above him, but by then it was too late. He made a last-ditch attempt to dodge the ogre's sweeping cudgel, but its rounded head swooped down and struck his legs. Bellowing in pain, he toppled against an orc, severing its thigh as he fell, before tumbling onward through the army of legs. He lashed out with his axe until there were no more orcs within his reach.
"Come here and fight, you cowards!"
he snarled. The enemy paid him no attention. Fired by an insatiable hunger, they streamed past him toward the gateway. They had no need of stringy dwarf flesh when there were tastier morsels in Girdlegard. Trembling with pain, Glendalin rose up on his elbows. The rest of his kinsfolk were dead, their mutilated bodies strewn on the ground, surrounded by scores of enemy corpses. The diamonds on Giselbert's belt sparkled in the sunlight, marking the place where the fifthling father had fallen, slain by a trio of ogres. At the sight of him, Glendalin's soul ached with sorrow and pride. The sun rose above the mountains, flooding through the gateway and dazzling Glendalin with its light. He raised a hand to his sensitive eyes, straining to see the gateway.
"Praise be to Vrakas! The gates were closed!"
A blow from behind sent pain searing through his chest. For the duration of a heartbeat, the tip of a spear protruded through his tunic, then withdrew. He slumped, gasping, to the ground.
What in the name of—
The assassin stepped round his body and knelt beside him. The smooth, elven face was framed by fine, fair hair that shimmered in the sunlight like a veil of golden threads. But the vision bore a terrible deformity. Two fathomless pits stared from almond-shaped holes. The creature wore armor of black metal that reached to its knees. Its legs were clad in leather breeches and dark brown boots. Burgundy gloves protected its fingers from grime, and its right hand clasped a spear, whose steel tip, sharp enough to penetrate the fine mesh of dwarven chainmail, was moist with blood. The strange elf spoke to the dwarf. At first, the words meant nothing to Glendalin, but their morbid sound filled him with dread.
My friend said, "Look at me, Synthoras is your death,"
a second voice translated behind him.
"I will take your life, and the land will take your soul."
Glendalin coughed, blood rushing from his mouth and coursing down his beard.
"Get out of my sight, you pointy-eared monster! I want to see the gates!"
he said gruffly, brandishing his axe to ward away the beast. The weapon almost flew from his grip. His strength was ebbing fast.
"Out of my way, or I'll cut you in two like a straw, you treacherous elf!" he thundered.
Synthoras laughed coldly. Raising his spear, he inserted the tip slowly between the tight rings of mail.
"You are mistaken, my friend. We are the Elfar, and we have come to slay the elves," the voice said softly. "The gates may be closed, but the power of the land will raise you from the dead, and from that moment on, you will be one of us. You know the incantation. You will open the door."
"Never! My soul belongs to Vrakas!"
"Your soul belongs to the land, and you will belong to the land until the end of time," the velvety voice cut him short. "Die, so you can return and deliver Gerdlegard to us."
The spear's sharp tip pierced the flesh of the helpless, dying dwarf. Pain stopped his tongue. Synthoras raised the weapon and pushed down gently on the battered body. The final blow was dealt tenderly, almost reverently. The creature waited for death to claim its prey, watching over Glendalin's pain-ravaged features and drinking in the memory. Finally, when he was certain that the last custodian of the gateway had departed, Synthoras left his vigil and rose to his feet. Chapter 1. Enchanted Realm of Ionandar, Gerdlegard, Spring, 6234th Solar Cycle. A volley of raps rang out as the hammer danced on the glowing ore. With each blow, the metal took shape, curving into a crescent as the iron submitted to the blacksmith's strength and skill. Suddenly, the jangling ceased, and a pair of tongs swooped down and tossed the metal back into the furnace. The blacksmith gave a grunt of displeasure.
"What do you think you're doing, Tangdil?"
the waiting man demanded impatiently. Iden, a groom in the service of Lotionan the Magus, stroked the horse's nose.
"The nag can't wait forever, you know. She's supposed to be pulling the plough."
Tungdil dipped his hands into a pail of water and used the brief hiatus to wash away the grime. The dwarf wore leather breeches and a brown beard clipped close to his chin. He was naked from the waist up, save for a leather apron. Running his brawny fingers through his long, dark hair, he shook out the sweat and let the drops of cool water trickle across his scalp.
"Oh, the shoe would never have fit,"
came his brief response. He pumped the bellows, producing a tortured hiss like the breath of a wheezing giant. The air breathed red-hot life into the glowing coals.
"Nearly there now."
He repeated the procedure, this time to his satisfaction, and fitted the shoe to the nag. A foul-smelling cloud of yellowish smoke enveloped Tungdil as the iron singed the horny sole. He dunked the shoe into the pail, allowing the metal to cool, then held it to the hoof again and drove nails through the holes. Setting the hind leg down gingerly, he retreated hastily, The animal, a strong, broad-backed grey, was too big for his liking. Iden sniggered and stroked the plowhorse.
"How'd you like your new shoe?" he asked her.
"The smith's a midget, granted, but at least he knows his stuff. Just watch you don't trip over him."
He hurried from the forge and marched the horse toward the fields. The dwarf stretched and gave his powerful arms a shake as he strolled to the furnace. The groom's jibes did not rile him. Teasing, affectionate or otherwise, was something he was inured to, having grown up in Ionunda, the only dwarf in a human realm. He stood more chance of finding gold by the wayside than encountering another of his kind.
"All the same, I should like to meet one," he thought.
His gaze swept the orderly forge, taking in the rows of tongs and hammers hanging neatly from the walls.
"I'd ask about the 5 dwarven folks."
The light in the forge was dim, but Tungdil liked it that way, because it brought out the beauty of the fiery coals. He worked the bellows, chasing sparks into the chimney as he fanned the flames. For a moment his face lit up as he imagined the glowing red dots flitting through the sky and taking their place in the firmament to shine brightly as stars. It was the same satisfaction that he derived from letting his hammer bounce up and down on the red-hot metal.
"Do real dwarven smiths do things differently?" he wondered.
"Why is it always so dark in here?"
Without warning, Sunya, the 8-year-old daughter of Frala, the kitchen maid, appeared at his side. A bright child, she was refreshingly untroubled by Tungdil's appearance. The dwarf's kindly face creased from ear to ear. It was astonishing how quickly human children grew. The girl would soon be taller than he was.
"You're as bad as cats, you children, sneaking up on me like that.
I'll tell you all about it if you help me heat the iron."
He tossed a lump of metal into the furnace. Eagerly, the fair-haired girl joined him at the bellows. As ever, he pretended to let her take over, allowing her to believe that she was compressing the firm leather pouch with her strength alone. Soon the metal took on a reddish glow.
"Do you see now?"
Reaching forward with the tongs, he gripped the nugget of iron and laid it on the anvil.
"It's not for nothing that I work without light. A blacksmith needs to know when the metal has reached the right temperature. Left to slumber in its toasty bed of coals, the iron overheats, but raised too soon, the brittle metal can't be forged."
Tungdil was rewarded with an earnest nod. The child looked exactly like Frala.
"My mother says you're a master blacksmith."
"I wouldn't go that far," he protested, laughing. "I'm just good at my job."
He winked at her, and she smiled. What Tungdil didn't mention was that he had never received instruction in his trade. Watching his predecessor at work had been all the training he'd needed. Whenever the man set down his tools, Tungdil had seized his chance to practice, mastering the essentials in no time. Now, 30 solar cycles later, no job was too big or too difficult for him. Lost in their thoughts, Tungdil and Sunya watched as the flames changed color. First orange, then yellow, red, white, and blue. The glowing coals sputtered and crackled. Just as the dwarf was about to inquire what cook would be serving for luncheon, a man appeared in the doorway, black against the rectangle of light.
"You're needed in the kitchens, Tungdil,"
came the imperious voice of Jolasin, a famulus in the 4th tier of Lot Ionan's apprentices.
"Well, since you asked so nicely..."
Tungdil turned to Sunya.
"Be sure not to touch anything."
On his way out, he pocketed a small metal object, and then followed the apprentice into the vaults of Lot Ionan's school. 200 or so students of all ages had been selected to learn the secrets of sorcery from the Magus. To the dwarf's mind, magic was a slippery, unreliable occupation. He felt more at home in his forge, where he could hammer as loudly as he pleased. Jolasin's dark blue robes billowed as he walked, his combed hair bobbing about his shoulders. Tungdil eyed the youth's fine garments and coiffure and grinned.
"The vanity of the boy."
They entered a large room, and an appetizing smell wafted toward them. Sure enough, cooking pots were simmering and bubbling above 2 hearths. Tungdil saw at once why his services were required. The pots were suspended on chains from the ceilings, but one of them had slipped its pulley and was sitting in the flames. Lifting the vessel required more strength than a woman could muster, and none of the apprentices were willing to help. They considered themselves a cut above kitchen work, refusing to dirty their hands or burn their fingers when others, such as smiths, could do the work. The cook, a stately woman of impressive girth, hurried over.
"Hurry!"
she cried anxiously, reaching up to stay her escaping hairnet.
"My goulash will be spoiled!"
"We can't have that. I'm starving," said Tungdil.
Without wasting time, he marched over to the hearth, touched the chain lightly to gauge its temperature, then seized the rusty links. Cycle after cycle at the anvil had strengthened his muscles until even the heaviest hammer felt weightless in his arms. A pot of goulash on a pulley was nothing by comparison.
"Here," he said to Jollison, proffering him the grimy chain. "Hold this while I fix it."
The young man hesitated.
"Are you sure it's not too heavy for me?"
he asked nervously.
"You'll be fine,"
Tungdil reassured him. He grinned.
"And if you're half as good at magic as you say you are, you can always make it lighter."
He pressed the chain into the apprentice's hands and let go. With a muttered curse, the famulus threw his weight against the dangling pot.
"Ow!" he protested. "It's hot!"
"That's my goulash you're holding,"
the cook reminded him darkly. Conceding defeat to her hairnet, she allowed her brown mop to fall across her pudgy face.
"I don't care if you're a famulus. I'll take my rolling pin to you if you let go of that chain."
Her plump arms rippled as she balled her fists. On discovering the source of the problem, Tungdil decided to punish Jollison by delaying the repair.
"Oh, this won't be easy,"
he said in a voice of feigned dismay. Frala raised her pretty green eyes from the potatoes she was peeling, saw what he was up to, and giggled. At last he made the necessary adjustments and checked the mechanism again. The pulley held, and the goulash was safe.
"You can let go now."
Jollison did as instructed, then inspected his dirty hands. Some of the grime had transferred itself to his precious blue robes. He shot a suspicious look at Frala, who was laughing out loud. His color rose.
"That's exactly what you were hoping for, isn't it, you stunted wretch?"
He took a step toward Tungdil and raised his fist, then stopped. The dwarf was considerably stronger than he was. Angrily, he stormed away. Tungdil watched him go and smirked.
"If he wants a fight, he shall have one. It's a pity he lost his nerve."
He wiped his hands on his apron. Frala fished an apple from the basket beside her and tossed it to him.
"Poor Jollison," she said with a chuckle.
"His fine gown is all soiled."
"He should have been more careful."
He shrugged and strolled over. Like him, Frala was responsible for the little things that contributed to the smooth running of the school.
"But I'll excuse his clumsiness just this once."
His kind eyes looked at her brightly from among his laughter lines.
"You two deserve each other," Frala sighed. "If you're not careful, someone will come to a bad end because of your feuding."
There was a splash as she dropped a peeled potato into the waiting tub of water.
"What did he expect when he dyed my beard? You know what they say, make a noise in a mine shaft and you're bound to hear an echo."
Tungdil ran a hand over his stubbly beard.
"I had to shave my chin thanks to his stupid spell. He must have known we'd be sworn enemies after that."
"I thought orcs were your worst enemy," she said archly.
"Well, I've made an exception for him. Beards are sacred, and if I were a proper dwarf, I'd kill him for his insolence. I'm too easy going for my own good."
He bit into the apple hungrily. With his left hand, he took something from the pouch at his waist and pressed it into Frala's hand.
"For you."
She looked down at her palm and saw three horseshoe nails, painstakingly forged together to form a homemade talisman. She stroked the dwarf's cheek fondly.
"What a lovely gift. Thank you, Tungdil."
She got up, fetched a length of twine, threaded it through the pendant, and knotted it deftly round her neck. The talisman nestled against her bare skin.
"Does it suit me?" she asked coyly.
"Anyone would think it had been made for you," he said,
thrilled that Frala was wearing the iron trinket as proudly as if Girdlegard's finest jeweler had designed and forged the piece. There was a special bond between the pair of them. The dwarf had known Frala since she was a baby, and had watched her mature into an attractive young woman who turned the heads of Lot Ionan's apprentices. These days she had two daughters of her own, Sunya and 1-year-old Ikana. Cycles ago, when Frala was still a girl, he had made tin figures for her to play with, showed her around the forge, and let her work the bellows. Dragon's breath, she used to call it, as the sparks flew up the chimney, accompanied by her laughter. Frala never forgot the pains he had taken to entertain her, nor how he cared for her daughter. She shook the remaining potatoes into the tub and topped up the water. As she turned round, her green eyes looked at him keenly.
"It's funny," she said with a smile. "I was just thinking how you haven't changed a bit in all the cycles I've known you."
Half of Tungdil's apple had already disappeared. Still munching, he made himself comfortable on a stool.
"And I was just thinking how splendidly we get on together," he said simply.
"Frala!"
the cook shouted.
"I'm going for some herbs! You'll have to stir the goulash!"
The ladle, its stem scarcely shorter than Tungdil, changed hands. The cook hurried out.
"You better not let it stick," she warned.
A delicious smell of goulash rose from the pot as Frala gave the stew a vigorous stir.
"All the others look older," she said. "Even the Magus. But you've stayed the same for 23 cycles. How do you think you'll look in another 23?
The topic was one that Tungdil was reluctant to consider. From what he had read about dwarves, it seemed he was destined to live for 300 cycles or more. Even now it grieved him to think that he would see the death of Frala and her daughters, of whom he had grown so fond. With these thoughts in mind, he popped the apple core into his mouth.
"Who knows, Frala?"
he mumbled, hoping to dismiss the gloomy subject. The maid had a particular knack for reading his mind that morning.
"Can I ask you something, Tungdil?"
He nodded.
"Do you promise you'll look after my daughters when I'm gone?"
He choked on the sour apple pips, scratching his throat in the process.
I don't think we need to worry about that now. Why, you'll live to be..."
He looked her up and down.
100 cycles at least. I'll ask the Magus to give you eternal life. And Sunya and Ikana too, of course."
Frala laughed.
"Oh, I'm not intending to meet Palandiel quite yet."
She kept stirring dutifully, even though her forehead was dripping with perspiration.
"But all the same, I'd feel better if I knew you were there to take care of them."
Her shoulders lifted in a helpless shrug.
"Please, Tungdil, say you'll be their guardian."
"Frala, by the time you're summoned to your goddess, Sunya and Ikana will be old enough to look after themselves."
Realizing that she was in earnest, he duly gave his word.
"I'd be honored to be their guardian."
He slid from the stool.
"If the chain slips again, send Jolasin to find me."
He made his way out with a small bowl of goulash to sustain him until lunch. On returning to the forge, he found Sunya waiting for him with yet another commission from Aiden, 2 wooden barrels whose iron hoops had split. No sooner had he started work than the plough was brought in, needing urgent repair. Tungdil relished the work. The fierce flames and physical effort made it a sweaty business, and soon perspiration was trickling down his arms and plopping into the fire with a hiss. Frala's daughter watched in fascination, passing him tools whenever she was strong enough to lift them, and working the bellows with all her might. The glowing metal yielded to his hammer, letting him shape it as he pleased. At times like this, he almost felt like a proper dwarf, and not just a foundling raised by humans. His mind began to drift. He had reached the age of 63 solar cycles without seeing another of his kind, which was why he looked forward to being sent away on errands. The occasions when Lot Ionan required his services as a messenger were regrettably few and far between. There was nothing Tungdil wanted more than to meet one of his own people and learn about his race, but the chances of encountering a traveling dwarf were infinitesimally small. The realm of Iona belonged exclusively to humans. There were a few gnomes and kobolds, but their races were almost extinct. Those that remained lived in remote caves beneath the surface, emerging only when there was something worth stealing, or so Frala said. The last of the elven people lived in Alandur, amid the glades of the Eternal Forest, while the dwarves inhabited the 5 ranges bounding Girdlegard. Tungdil had almost given up hope of visiting a dwarven kingdom and finding out about his folk. Everything he knew about dwarves stemmed from Lot Ionan's library, but it was a dry kind of knowledge, empty and colourless. In some of the Magus's books, the writers called the dwarves groundlings and poked fun at them, while others blamed his people for opening Gerdlegard to the northern hordes. Tungdil refused to believe it. But he could understand why so few of his kind ventured outside their kingdoms. His kinsfolk were almost certainly offended by such prejudice, and preferred to turn their backs on humankind. Tungdil was putting the finishing touches to the first of the iron hoops when Jolassin appeared at the door, wearing, as Tungdil noted with satisfaction, a clean set of robes.
"Hurry!"
he spluttered, panting for breath.
"Don't tell me it's the goulash again," said Tungdil, grinning. "Why don't you run along and hold the chain until I get there?"
"It's the laboratory!"
Barely able to get the words out, Jolassin resorted to gestures.
"The chimney!"
he gasped, turning and hurrying away. This time it sounded serious. The dwarf set down his hammer in consternation and wiped his hands on his apron. Once Sunya had been dispatched to join her mother in the kitchen, he chased after the famulus through the underground galleries hewn into the stone. Border Territory, Secondling Kingdom, Gerdlegard, Winter, 6233rd Solar Cycle. Tens of hundreds of tiny grains of sand pelted their helms, shields, mail, and every inch of unprotected flesh. Battered by the gusts, the brave band of dwarves struggled onward, mounted on ponies. Scarves muffled their faces, but the cloth was no match for the fine desert sand, which worked its way through the fabric, clogging their beards and grinding between their teeth.
"The deviled wind,"
cursed Gandagar Silverbeard, of the clan of the Silverbeards, king of the Fourthling's 12 clans. He tugged at his scarf, pulling it over his nose. At 298 cycles of age, Gandagar was a respected leader and accomplished warrior. He stood a little over 5 feet tall, and his arms were strong and powerful. His heavy tunic of finely forged mail was worn with pride, despite the trying circumstances. Beneath his diamond-studded helmet, his hair and beard were brown and wiry. He led the party unflinchingly through the sand and scree.
"It's the sand that gets me. I've never seen a sandstorm below the surface," complained Bislapur Surestroke, the friend and mentor riding at his side.
He was taller and brawnier than the monarch, and his hands and arms were laden with almost as many golden rings and bangles. He looked every inch the warrior, his chainmail bearing the scars of countless battles. The freshest marks were just 5 orbits old, the result of a skirmish with orcs.
"Vrakas knew what he was doing when he sculpted us from rock. Dwarves and deserts don't mix."
The verdict was shared by the rest of the troop. The ponies that had borne them on their long journey to the Secondling Kingdom snorted and whinnied fractiously, trying to clear their nostrils, but blocking them further with all-pervasive sand.
"There's no other way of getting there,"
Gandagar said apologetically.
"You'll be pleased to know that the worst is behind us."
The band of 30 dwarves was in Sangpur, a desolate human realm under Queen Umilante's rule. The landscape consisted of nothing but barren dunes and godforsaken wasteland, a vista so cheerless that the dwarves preferred to stare at the tangled manes of their ponies or the tips of their boots. Their journey south from the Brown Range had taken them through the lush valleys and steep gorges of the mountainous state of Urgon, where Lothair reigned. From there, they had ridden over the gentle plains of King Tilogorn's Eidoslane, where the slightest hillock qualified as a mountain, and shady forests gave way to fertile fields. The passage through Sangpur was the last and most grueling leg of the journey, a swathe of desert 40 miles wide, lying at the foot of the mountains, like a moat of fine sand. It was almost as though nature wanted to prevent the rest of Gerdlegard, including the Fourthlings, from reaching the range. On occasions, the wind dropped, and the veil of sand fell, allowing the mighty peaks to loom before them magically among the dunes. The dwarves felt the call of the snow-capped mountains, and longed for cool air, fresh water, and the company of their kin. Bislapur tightened the scarf around his cheeks and stroked his graying beard.
"I'm no friend of magic, but if ever we needed a sorcerer, it's now," he growled. "Why? He could command the wretched wind to stop."
A final gust swirled toward them. Then the gales died unexpectedly. Only 5 miles separated the dwarves from the comb of rock that ran from east to west.
"You're not a bad sorcerer yourself," said Gandagar, breathing a sigh of relief.
He had never been especially fond of the world outside his kingdom, and this latest foray had persuaded him that one epic journey in a lifetime was more than enough.
"What did I tell you? We're almost there."
Rising out of the gloom of the mountain's shadows were the imposing walls of Ogre's Death. The stronghold grew out of the rock, the main keep hewn into the foothills, the battlements extending down the hillside in 4 separate terraces that were all but impregnable. Cut into the walls of the uppermost terrace was the stronghold's entrance, 8 paces wide and 10 paces high.
"Like an enormous mouth," thought Gandagar. "It looks as though the mountain is yawning."
As the company neared the stronghold, the doors opened welcomingly. 17 banners fluttered loftily from the turrets, bearing the insignia of the Secondling clans.
"Here at last," Gandagar said thankfully. "To think we've ridden right across Gurdlakad."
The other dwarves joined in his grateful laughter. They were his retinue, a heavily armed band who had escorted him throughout the long journey to the Secondling Kingdom. Between them, they were the cream of Goimdil's folk, skilled in axe-work and craftsmanship, the best warriors and artisans from each of the 12 Fourthling clans. Many a legend told of the fighting prowess of the dwarves, which explained why the party had not been troubled by a single brigand or thief. They were carrying enough gold to make an ambush more than worth the risk. Bislapur waved his hand imperiously, and his summons was instantly obeyed. A little fellow, measuring just 3 feet in height, slid from his pony awkwardly, and came running through the sand. He wore a wide belt around his baggy breeches, and looked oddly sinewy in appearance, despite the considerable paunch that rounded his Hessian shirt. The yellowed undergarment was paired with a red jacket, and his blue cap was pulled low over his face, a pointed ear protruding on either side. A silver choker encircled his neck, and his buckled shoes kicked up clouds of sand as he scampered through the dunes. He bowed at Bislapur's feet.
"Svirt, at your service, but not of his own accord," he said peevishly.
"Silence!"
thundered Bislapur, raising his powerful fist. The gnome ducked away.
"Ride on, and announce our arrival. Wait for us at the gates, and don't touch anything that doesn't belong to you."
"Since I don't have a choice in the matter, I shall do as you say."
The gnome bowed again and hurried to his pony. Soon he was galloping away from the dwarves in the direction of the stronghold. Even from a distance, it was obvious that Sverd was no horseman. He bounced up and down in the saddle, clinging to his cap with claw-like fingers, and relying on the pony to set their course.
"He'll unman himself if he goes any faster. When are you finally going to set him free?"
asked Gandagar.
"Not until he's served his penance," Bislapur answered tersely. "Let's not delay."
He pressed his heels into the pony's broad flanks, and the animal set off at an obedient trot. The Fourthlings knew Ogre's Death from etchings and stories, but now they were seeing it for the first time for themselves. Hundreds of cycles had passed since the last dwarf of Goimdil journeyed through Gurdlagard to visit his kinsfolk in the south. In ancient times, the dwarven folks had come together every few cycles to celebrate festivals in honor of Frakas and thank the smith for creating their race. But the fall of the Stone Gateway, the invasion of the orcs, ogres, and Alfar, and the annihilation of the Fifthlings had put a stop to that.
"Thank Frakas we're here," sighed Gandagar, standing up in his stirrups to give his saddle-sore bottom a brief respite.
None of the company had any instinct for riding. As true dwarves, they would never consent to making a journey on horses. The beasts were untrustworthy, and the saddles could be reached only by means of a stepladder, which was far too undignified. It was bad enough riding on ponies. Their distrust of the animals ran so deep that 2 of the party refused to ride altogether and were traveling in small, easily maneuverable chariots at the back of the procession.
"We'll all be glad when the journey is over,"
said Bislapur, spitting sand from his mouth. The woes of their travels were partly forgotten, as Ogre's Death's magnificent masonry loomed into view. Gandagar's eyes traveled over the exquisitely ornamented turrets and walls. Even the outermost rampart was a work of art, graced with plinths, statues, pillars, and other embellishments.
Our folk boast the finest gem cutters and diamond polishers, but Berowyn's masons are second to none.
The gates to the first of the four terraces swung open, and Gandagar's company was admitted to a courtyard. Sverd had dismounted, and was standing by his pony. Bislapur signalled for him to fall in at the rear of the group. Dwarves seldom showed their age, but the figure who came toward them had seen 300 cycles or more.
"Greetings, King Gandagar Silverbeard of Goimdil's folk. My name is Belendilin Onearm of the Clan of the Firmfingers, and on behalf of our ruler, Gundrabur Whitecrown, High King of all Dwarves, I welcome you and your company to the Secondling Kingdom of Berowyn's folk."
Clad in a tunic of chainmail, the stocky dwarf was carrying a battle axe at his waist. His weapons belt was secured by a finely worked stone clasp. Marble trinkets had been braided into his greying beard, and a long plait dangled behind him.
"Come, brothers, follow me."
He started on the path that rose toward the stronghold. As he turned, the fourthlings noticed that he was missing one arm. Gandagar conjectured that the limb had been lost to one of Teon's minions. In all other respects, the secondling was powerfully built, perhaps because of the strength required for working with stone. His right hand was heavily calloused, almost bear-like in size, the fingers exuding a power that lived up to the name of his clan. The company followed Belendilin through several gateways until they reached the fourth and final terrace, where he signalled for them to stop. At last they could appreciate the full genius of the stronghold's design. Their host gestured to the doors that led into the mountain.
"Dismount and leave your ponies here. We'll take good care of them, I assure you. The delegates are expecting you in the Great Hall."
He led the procession into a tunnel of such vast proportions that a dragon could have entered with ease. What truly took the visitor's breath away, though, was the masonry. 9-sided stone columns, each measuring 10 paces in circumference, rose like fossilized trees. The ceiling was so high as to be invisible, the columns soaring into space.
"Perhaps the crown of the mountain is supported by pillars," thought Gandagar, gazing at his surroundings in awe.
Stone arches, richly decorated with carvings, spanned the columns, inscribed with verses and citations from the creation story of the dwarves. Ahead of them towered an enormous stone statue of Berowyn, father of the Secondlings. The ancient monarch sat on a throne of white marble, his right hand raised in greeting and his left hand clasped about his axe. His foot alone was as long as 5 ponies and loomed to the height of a fully grown dwarf. But that was just the start of it. The walls, once coarse naked rock, had been polished to a sheen and the glinting surfaces engraved with runes and patterns. The stonework was so delicate, so precise, that Gandagar slowed to examine it. There were underground galleries and chambers aplenty in his own kingdom, but nothing compared to the Secondling's skill. He reached out and ran his hand reverently over the dark grey marble. It was hard to believe such splendour was possible.
"By Vrakas," he exclaimed admiringly, "I've never seen such artistry. The Secondlings boast the best masons of any dwarven folk."
Gundrabur's counselor gave a little bow.
"Thank you. They will value your praise."
The company walked between the statue's feet and through another door. There the passageway narrowed and the air felt suddenly cool. They had reached the entrance to the hall. Belendilin turned to Gandagar and smiled.
"Are you ready to stake your claim before the assembly?"
"Of course he is,"
snapped Bislapur, before the king could speak. Belendilin frowned but said nothing, stepping forward to throw open the doors and announce the arrival of the long-awaited guests. The great hall surpassed everything that had gone before it. Cylindrical columns towered to vertiginous heights, and great battle scenes graced the walls, the sculpted marble surfaces commemorating past victories and heroic deeds. Lanterns and braziers of burning coal bathed the chamber in a warm, reddish glow, but the air was cool, much to the delight of the travellers who had endured the heat of Sangpur's deserts. While Belendilin was introducing the new arrivals, Gandagar fixed his advisor with a stare.
"You would have beaten Sverd for such insolence."
Bislapur clenched his jaw.
"I'll apologize to the counselor later."
They turned toward the assembly. 5 chairs, one for each of the dwarven folks, were arranged in a semicircle around a table. Elegantly carved pews were lined up in 5 blocks behind them, so that the chieftains and elders could follow the proceedings and have their say. One of the chairs, together with its corresponding benches, would remain forever empty, a painful reminder of the Fifthling's fate. There was no sign of the Firstling monarch or chieftains, but the 17 clans of the Secondlings had taken their seats. The table was covered in maps and charts of Girdlegard. Before the Fourthling's arrival, the delegates had been discussing the happenings in the north, but now their attention turned to Gandagar. The king felt a rush of excitement. For the first time in over 400 cycles, the most influential and powerful dwarves of all the folks would be assembled in one room. Never before had he been in the presence of his fellow monarchs and distant kin, and at last the names that he had heard so often attached themselves to beings of flesh and blood. It was a momentous occasion. The other dwarves rose to greet the company with hearty handshakes. Gandagar noticed how the palms differed. Some were calloused or scarred, others tough and muscular, while a few seemed almost delicate. He was touched by the warmth of the welcome, despite the distrust and suspicion evident in some eyes. Then it was time for him to greet Gundrabur Whitecrown, king of the Secondlings and ruler of every dwarf, clan, and folk. He stepped forward and struggled to hide his shock. After 500 cycles of life, the once stately High King was so weak that the mildest breeze was liable to extinguish his inner fires. His eyes, dull and yellowed, flicked back and forth, unable to settle. It seemed to Gandagar that the monarch stared straight through him. Because of his great age, the High King did without cumbersome mail, his feeble body wrapped in embroidered robes of brown fabric. His silvery hair and beard swept the floor, and in his lap was the crown that symbolized his office, too heavy for him to bear.
The ceremonial hammer lay beside his throne, its head etched with runes and its handle inlaid with gems and precious metals that sparkled in the light of the braziers and lanterns.
It seemed doubtful that the monarch could summon the strength to lift the heavy relic. Gandagar cleared his throat and swallowed his trepidation.
"You summoned me as your successor, Your Majesty, and now I stand before you," he said, addressing the High King with the time-honored formula.
Gundrabur inclined his head as if to speak, but no sound came out.
"The High King thanks you for following his summons. He knows that the journey was arduous and long,"
Melinda Lynn explained on the monarch's behalf. "If the